Start. And we're holding on Nuntes Omer Aleph, the 10th line. We discussed yesterday the Mishnah had said that when an animal goes and eats some of the crops in a field, then we said you evaluate the shishim according to 60 times as much. And we had several different, we had some discussion and several different opinions about how exactly we calculate that. Rashi had said that you make a double evaluation. First, you figure out how much one base saw in that field would be worth relative to if 60 base saw of it were to be sold, on the grounds of that people don't usually buy a saw at a time. So to deal with the price of one saw by itself would be an inflated price. So you figure out the price of 60, divide it by the value of 60, the price of 60 saw, divide that by 60 to get the value of one saw. And then you figure out how much that one individual saw was reduced in value by what the animal ate. According to Tosfos, we said you don't have that double evaluation. You just figure out you just figure out according to 60 times the area that was damaged. Meaning Tosfos said base saw in the Mishnah hadn't meant an area where you plant a saw as it usually does in Gemara terminology. Rather, it means if the animal ate a saw, then we figure out how much would 60 saw of crops in that field be worth, and we go accordingly. And we said the Raivad says the saw is the minimum amount that we would start doing such an evaluation. Below that, if it eats less than that, then anyway, the guy's not going to be paying that much. So then we just figure the full value of it. Anyway, that got into a whole discussion then of a case involving a couple of brises that mentioned in particular one brisa that talked about where an animal ate unripe fruit. Of various kinds, unripe grain or unripe grapes or whatever, and we had different opinions in the Braisa of how you pay. Rabbi Yossi Aglili had said, as far as unripe grain, Rabbi Yossi Aglili said you have to look at Meshuyer Shaboy, how is the rest of the crop going to end up? If it ends up, for example, Tosfos explains that if in the end all the rest of the crop ends up getting damaged later on that year by wind or hail or what have you, then you have to say, well, look, you know, this would have been also, therefore you shouldn't have to pay anything, or at least not very much. As opposed to if the entire crop makes it through unscathed, then this would have also. With grapes, we said, the Chum said that no, you figure out the previous value and the current value. We said, what about when the animal ate unripe grapes? So Rabbi Yeshua said you have to consider them as though they were ripe grapes. And Tosfos pointed out, because grapes, unlike grain, you have individual ones sometimes, and some get damaged and some don't. So therefore, you can't go to Meshuyer Shaboy. The Chum again said, you see, Kama Haisi Yafa, but Kama Hu Yafa, how much was it worth before? How much was it worth now? Then we had Reb Shimon ben Yehuda saying in the name of Reb Shimon, that is Reb Shimon ben Yehoi, that there's a difference at what stage of the growth of the fruit it ate him. If it ate him at a middle stage of the growth of the fruit, then we consider it as though it was ready to be harvested. So he would disagree with Rabbi Yeshua that you say that at such an early stage, but you would say it at a later stage. So now continuing on that subject of figuring out b'shishim and analyzing the opinions in this braisa, Omer Abaye, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Shmuel, Amru Davar Echad. It comes out that Rabbi Yossi Aglili and Rabbi Shmuel both said basically the same point. Abaye often does that kind of thing in Shas. Often he will point out that there is a group of Tanoim where it comes out, when you analyze what they say, it comes out they're all basing themselves on the same point. We often have, there's a rule actually from the that goes back to the Goinim that says, Ein halacha kashita, when we say that a certain group of Tanoim, Omru Davar Echad, it also amounts to saying the halacha is not like them, because it means they said, according to this logic, but the other Chachamim all disagree with them, and the halacha is like the majority as it usually is. Anyway, Rabbi Yossi Aglili Hodam Moran, Rabbi Yossi Aglili's opinion, we just said that he says, that when the animal ate unripe grain, you have to consider what the rest of the grain would have come out like. You wait until the end of the season, until the harvest season, see how the rest of the grain came out, and then based on that is how you evaluate the amount he has to pay. Which again, as to say, in other words, that if the rest of the crop got damaged, then he's not going to be paying anything or not very much because this would have gotten damaged as well. So Rabbi Yosi really says that. Rabbi Shmuel, the Tanya, we see Rabbi Shmuel says makes a similar point in the sense that he says, we learned earlier in the Masechta, when the Pasuk says about a mazik, mate of Sadehu, mate of Kamri Yishalim, that the owner of the animal or whatever it is that caused the hezek has to pay with the best of his field or the best of his vineyard, the best of whose, so mate of Sadehu Shal Nizik or mate of Kamri Shal Nizik, Divrei Rabbi Shmuel had said that we go according to the best of the Nizik's property. We talked about in the first parak, we have the case, for example, where the Nizik has better quality, has where the Nizik has the Nizik's best quality field is only equal to the worst quality field of the Mazik. And according to Rabbi Shmuel, we said that the Mazik can get away with paying his worst quality field. I, for him, it's worst quality, it's Ziboris, but relative to the Nizik, it's Idis, and that's good enough. On the other hand, we said Rabbi Akiva Omer, that Rabbi Akiva had said the Pasuk is only coming to tell you that Nizokin collect from Idis, meaning we said in the first parak that means one way of understanding Rabbi Akiva is to say is that he's saying that he disagrees with that. And says that no, you go according to the Mazik's best. So in the case that we just described, the Mazik would have to pay with his best field, even his best quality field, even though it's far better than anything the Nizik has. But kavachoymala hektish, and how much more so hektish? That it collects from Idis, where we discussed in the first parak what Rabbi Akiva means. What Rabbi Akiva means by that. It means so. First, we discussed does it, we ended up saying that Rabbi Akiva holds like an opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh that says that if a shur of a regular person damaged a shur of Hekdesh, then you're going to be paying Nezek Shalim. Unlike the Chacham who hold that in that case you'd be Potter. Rabbi Akiva is basically saying Kavachomer, if you have to pay a Hedyot from the best, how much more so you have to pay Hekdesh from the best. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva disagrees with that point.
Okay.
The point is, we see that Rabbi Shmuel says you go according to the best of the Nizik. Now, the Gemara points out, now don't think that what Rabbi Shmuel means is the way Rabbi Idi Bar Oven explained it, which we had in that Gemara. So we had when we were discussing back in the first parak, what does Rabbi Shmuel mean about mate of Sadehu Shal Nizek? On the face of it, it sounds like Rabbi Shmuel is saying no matter what kind of crop or what kind of land the animal damaged, you're always paying an equal amount of that of the Nizek's idis. And the question was, how could that be? The question was, if your animal went in and ate off of the Nizik Ziburis, off his worst quality land, why should you be required to pay as though that land was the best quality and pay that equivalent amount?
What's so
an aruga is a plot of land. So we said over there, so in that sugya, we had something that Rabbi Idi Bar Oven explained, the Amr Rabbi Idi Bar Oven, aruga ben ha'arugas, the case would be where the animal ate from one plot among all the other plots in the field. We don't know whether this particular one was poor quality crop or good quality. So then we tell him that you have to go pay the equivalent amount of one of the good plots in that land. Now, in other words, Rabbi Idi Bar Oven was saying like this. Suppose you have the Nizik has a field where, let's say you have he has Idis, Benes, and Ziburis in that field.
Nizik or the Mazik?
The Nizik we're talking about, because that's where the animal went into. Okay. So the Nizik has, let's say, one field that has in it. He has some plots in it. Let's say he has a bunch of plots in it that are all planted with the same kind of fruit or vegetable or grain to keep things simple. So let's say, for example, among those, he has some of them where the crop is better quality and it's going to be worth $20 a pound, and others where it's lesser quality and it's only $10 a pound, and others where it's even less and it's only $5 a pound. So now, what Rabbi Idiba Oven was saying when Rabbi Shmuel says you pay according to Idis of Nizik, what he means is, so now the animal went in there, it damaged the crop in one of those plots, and we don't know which one. We would tell the owner of the animal, you are responsible for paying $20 in case the one that it damaged was the highest quality. So Rabbi Idiba Oven had explained Rabbi Shmuel that way. Okay. But now we're saying we don't say that. Why don't we say that? And my timer, why don't we say that? Because as we learned there, after all, you would have to bring proof. You, the Nizik, are claiming that the animal damaged the $20 plot. The Mazik is saying no. At most, it damaged the $5 plot. Why should I have to pay 20 unless you can prove which one it was? Ela b'meita d'lekamei. Obviously, therefore, what does Rabbi Shmuel mean when he says that you pay according that you? What does it mean that you pay according to the idis of the nizik? It means the mate of Dilakameh, it means he's referring to what's going to be mate of later on, meaning that now it's in the middle of the season and the crops are still growing, and only later at the end of the season are we going to see that it's mate of or my new kihayak to solik. Namely, it's going to depend on how the crop ends up. So we see that just like Rabbi Yisrael Glili says previously in our discussion over here, that you go according to how the crop is going to end up. The same way we see that Rabbi Shmuel holds a similar svara. Now Tosfos points out in other places in the Gemara, the Gemara, including in Or Masechta and including in Gittin, we talked about that actually a different meaning of what Rabbi Shmuel says, namely what we were saying before, the case where the mazik had where the mazik's lowest quality field, his ziburis, is equal in quality to the nizik's idis, and we said Rabbi Shmuel had said that the mazik is able to pay with his ziburis because it's equal to the other guy's idis. So in that case, if that's what Rabbi Shmuel means, where is the Gemara all of a sudden getting over here that Rabbi Shmuel is referring to the future value of the crops in the field? And Tosfos says, fine, but Abaye is saying it does mean that, but it also means that Rabbi Shmuel is going according to what's left over, because when Rabbi Akiva continues, loy bo hakosu, the pasuk is only coming to do such and such, then Rabbi Abaye understands that Rabbi Akiva means that the pasuk is not coming to be machmir on the mazik as much as you're thinking of, just that it's coming to tell you that nizak can get from idis. And then Tosfos goes on to discuss, in other words, because then if the only argument is about the idis versus beninus versus the ziburis, then it comes out Rabbi Shmuel wouldn't be the one who's machmir. If anything, sometimes Rabbi Akiva would be the one who would be machmir. So since Rabbi Akiva's wording suggests that there's a case where Rabbi Shmuel is machmir, then therefore that brings Abaye to say that Rabbi Shmuel is talking about the future value of the field, and therefore in that sense he's similar to Rabbi Yossi Aglili, who also takes that point into account.
He's machmir on the mazik.
So he's
right?
therefore he's machmir on the mazik in the sense that we're saying that. That when we go when we talk about how much the animal ate, we have to consider not just the current value of it, the way the Chachamim say, you have to consider the future value of it. This unripe grain that the animal ate would have ended up becoming ripe grain, and therefore you have to consider that future value, which now we're now Abaye is saying that's similar to his understanding of Rabbi Shmuel, that it also that Rabbi Shmuel is looking at the future, at the potential future value of the crop, and going according to that. Next. Omar, now we said in the Braisa, the next point was we said Rabbi Shimon Yehuda Omer Mishum Rabbi Shimon. We said that Rabbi Shimon. Reb Shimon ben Yehuda had said in the name of Reb Shimon in the Braisa at the top of the Amud, Bamed Varam Amurim, when does all of this apply that, as the Chachamim say, we evaluate relative to the rest of the field, Bizman Sha'ochla, relative to 60 times as much as the Gemara had established before, Bizman Sha'ochla Lulagre Lulagre. Only if the animal had eaten from the grapevines or from the fig trees when the fruit is very immature. like we learned yesterday, Lulve Gfanim is the first stage of the
grapes.
Of the grapes growing. Rashi described that you can already see the shape of the you can already see the shape of the cluster of grapes, but you haven't really that hasn't blossomed yet. And the same thing, the same stage by figs would be called yichur. So Rav Shimon ben Yehuda had said that when would we say that you figure according to the value of the land as it is now is only when the animal ate very unripe fruit, which implies, the Gemara says, Hos smodar, implying that if the animal had eaten grapes when they were at a later stage called smodar, royan oisem kilo heina novim omnisli botzer. It sounds like then already Rav Shimon ben Yehuda is going to consider them like as though they were completely ripe. The problem with that, Ema Sefer, but we said, look at the next part of the Braisa, where Rav Shimon ben Yehuda continues, Ochla pagim oi boiser, only if the animal ate the figs or the grapes when they were in the stage of pagim or boiser, which is an even larger stage. What you have is, with grapes, it goes through the stages like this. First, you have the stage called Lulaveg Fanim, where it hasn't even blossomed yet. Then you have the stage called smodar, where it's blossomed, and you can there are tiny little grapes over there, but they're still, it's going to take them months until they ripen. And then you have the stage called boiser, which is actually defined earlier on the Amud based on Mishnayos in various places in Seder Zeroyim. It means when the grapes are the size of a white bean, where they're first considered fruit in halacha. So now, what is Rav Shimon ben Yehuda is saying that if the animal ate the grapes at the first stage, then we consider then we don't look at them as fully ripe fruit. We go based on the 60 times evaluation, like we said before. On the other hand, we're saying if it eats boiser, only then do we count it like they were fully ripe and ready to harvest grapes. Hos smodar, implying that if it was at the smodar stage, which is the intermediate stage between those, then he would agree with the chachamim that you go according to how much the vineyard was worth before the animal got in there, and how much is it worth after it got done with it. So the question is, what does Rav Shimon ben Yehuda hold as far as the what does he hold as far as the smodar stage? So Amar Ravina kroich v'toni. Ravina says you have to combine together. You have to combine together what we had in the Braisa. Meaning, in other words, that you have to add in smodar. You have to add in the smodar stage into what Rav Shimon ben Yehuda is saying. So you have to. So when you do that, then the Braisa reads as follows. If Shimon ben Yehuda would say, when is this talking about? Only if it ate them at the very first stage of their growth, then we would say that you go according to what the value of the vineyard was beforehand and how much it's worth now. But if it ate them at any later stage, whether we're talking about the second stage of smodar or whether we're talking about the third stage, which by figs would be called pagin and by grapes is called boiser, then we would treat them like fully ripe grapes. Well, then the Gemara asks, well, then doesn't it come out? Why doesn't it come out then that Rav Shimon ben Yehuda is saying the same thing as Rabbi Yeshua? Because Rabbi Yeshua also said that if it ate smodar, we consider them as though they're fully ripe grapes. Now, we should assume that different opinions in a Braisa usually are actually different opinions. Rav Shimon ben Yehuda, being from a later generation than Rabbi Yehuda, than Rabbi Yeshua, if he agrees with Rabbi Yeshua, it would say at most, it would say v'chein amar Rav Shimon ben Yehuda, not as though as it's a completely independent opinion of its own. Now Tosfos points out, okay, so why didn't the Gemara assume that maybe this smodar goes together with lulaveg fanim? Maybe Rav Shimon ben Yehuda holds that just as with lulaveg fanim, you're paying according to the previous and current value of the property, the same way it is with smodar. Why do we have to assume that smodar goes together with boiser? And the reason is because then Tosfos says because then it didn't have to mention lulavim at all. It could have just started with when it eats them when it eats them when it's smother, and we would have understood that of course it applies to lulav sanim as well. Therefore, the only way in order to have smother in there necessarily it has to go together with pagan and boiser. And the chiddush is that even at that earlier stage of smother, we would already consider it as though it was ripe enough. Mephoshim also deal with the question, why don't we assume that maybe smadar has some kind of intermediate din? Maybe we would say, for example, that you say like Rabbi Yossi Aglili, and you go according to how the rest of the crop would have ended up. Well, he doesn't say any such thing, so we have no reason, the Shittim Kovetzis brings from the Rosh, there's no reason to say such a thing when he himself didn't even hint at any such thing. And also, anyway, another point is also, listen, you're not going to say that by grapes themselves, you're going to say depending on one stage, you're going to go according to how the rest of the crop would have ended up. And then by another stage, you're going to go according to individually themselves. There's no reason to distinguish between that. Therefore, we would assume that it's the same thing. So now the question is that he's saying the same thing as Rabbi Yeshua. And the answer is, Ikabinayu, the difference between them is Tachash Gufna. The difference is, should we also take into consideration the weakening of the vine? Meaning, you have to consider, when fruit grows on a tree, or in this case, grapes grow on a grapevine, it takes a certain amount of energy out of the tree, or out of the vine, because, the energy for producing that fruit has to come from somewhere, and some of it comes from the vine itself. So now, should we consider, if the grapes had been left there to completely ripen, eventually, sure, the guy would have a whole cluster of ripe grapes, which are worth something. On the other hand, the grape vine itself would now be weaker because now it put some of its energy into producing those grapes. Meaning, in other words, that the future value of that vine is going to be less because of that. So, do we take that into consideration? Do we say, well, on the one hand, we should figure the value. So now let's say, so the we're saying that the animal ate the grapes when they were smadar. Both Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda are saying that you go according to the future value of those grapes, meaning we figure out, we say these grapes that are on this vine, had they been allowed to grow to maturity and been harvested, they would have been worth, let's say, $10. But do we factor in the fact, on the other hand, the vine would have lost a dollar of its value because it produced another crop? In other words, therefore, in future, this vine is not going to live. Show clearly which one of them holds what, because man tana d'chayish l'kachash gufna. Which tana is it that considers this kachash gufna kind of thing? This kind of thing where we factor in a different factor of what would have been in the future, and we adjust the payment accordingly. That is Reb Shimon ben Yehuda. We find specifically in another context that Reb Shimon ben Yehuda is the one who says that. So therefore, we can assume that he's the one who says that over here also. Therefore, so he would be the one who says that, yes, in the scenario we just said, the guy is only paying $9. The grapes would have been worth 10, but you have to deduct the kachash gufna. Whereas Rabbi Yeshua, we don't find anywhere that he says any such thing. So according to him, you would be paying 10. Where do we see Rabbi Shimon Yehuda saying such a thing? The Tanya. Rabbi Shimon Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon Menasya. Oinus, if we have, we learned back in Masech Tuksubas, you have all the dinim about oinus and the fata, where a man rapes or seduces a girl, a naira, not ma'urasa. If she's ma'urasa, then there are other dinim, then there's misa involved, but we're talking about where she's a naira and not ma'urasa. She's not makodesh to anybody. So if he's mafata her, then the Torah says that he has to pay a fine or he has to marry her and give her a full ksuba. And if it was an onus, then he has to pay a fine and he has to marry her. Anyway, so besides now, the Torah mentions an amount that he has to pay, 50 shkolim, but besides that, the Gemara deals with over there the point, he's also paying for the various kinds of damage that he did, including, so now the Chachamim say over there, he also has to pay, in the case of an onus, he has to pay for tzar, because after all, there was the pain of losing her besulin. On the other hand, Reb Shimon ben Yehuda, Reb Shimon ben Menasya, onus ain't a mashalam as a tzar. he says that an onus doesn't pay tzarim, because look, and if this and if he hadn't been onus her, eventually she would have gotten married, eventually she would have lost her besulim the first time she has relations with her husband, and she would have gone through the same pain. Therefore, Reb Shimon Yehuda is saying there's no reason to make the onus pay for that. He pays his 50. He pays other kinds of things. He pays boshes and pagam and whatever, but he shouldn't have to pay for tzah. Omru loy, and the Chacham answered him back, fine, you may say that there's a, you may say that she would have gone through it anyway, but after all, in a domain of elas baratzin, then of elas baonus, after all, there's a big difference whether it happened willingly, which would have been with her husband, versus now where it was by force. So therefore, so there is a different kind of tzah involved. And therefore he should have to pay for it. The point is, in other words, that we see that Rav Shimon Yehuda takes into consideration this kind of thing of kachash gufna, considering how things would have been in the future had it not been for this. He's saying, had it not been for the onus, there would have been that sire in the future. The same way he's saying over here, had it not been for the animal eating these grapes, then later on this grapevine would have been weaker because of it. So we see, therefore, therefore says Abaya, therefore, you can deduce from that that Reb Shimon ben Yehuda is the one who holds of that concept of kachash gufna in our sugya over here, and Rabbi Yeshua would disagree with that. So Omer Abaya. So now Rabbi Abaya points out another thing, another one of these examples where we see that different tanoim hold of the same basic principle. Omer Abaya, hani tanoi v'Reb Shimon ben Yehuda amru davar achad. The following tanoim that we're going to list are saying the same thing as Reb Shimon Yehuda in this regard, as far as kachash gufna, namely Reb Shimon Yehuda hada amaran. We just said what Reb Shimon Yehuda holds, that in the case of onus, we he doesn't pay the tsar because there would have been tsar anyway. By the way, Tosfos points out, obviously there are other kinds of tsar as well. I mean, there can also be there can also be other kinds of tsar if he hits her or whatever. We're not dealing with that. We're dealing specifically with the tsar of Besulin. Anyway, so now sort of Shimon Yehuda had said that. Hani Tanoi Maihi, what other Tanoim are we talking about that hold a similar concept? The Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. Now, we learned earlier in our Masechta, we learned in the previous Perek, you have the case where that the Torah deals with where two people are fighting and one of them hits a pregnant woman and causes her to miscarry. Actually, in the previous Perek, we mostly focused on what happens if a shur does that, where we said that we mostly focused on that a shur that does that, we say the owner is potter from Dmei Vlodis, because the whole concept of Dmei Vlodis only applies if a person injured her. But anyway, but we did touch on also the point when a person does it. Anyway, so so you paid Dmei Vlodis. Rashi points out now here when it comes to nezek, so you're also you are also paying nezek and sar, which is also included, Rashi says, in the Dmei Vlodis. There is a nezek involved in the sense that now she got injured and now she would have eventually given birth, but there she would have done it more calmly with a midwife. So therefore there is nezek and there is tsar involved. Rashi actually mentions over here that you pay tsar. Tosfos actually had discussed earlier Rashi and Tosfos had mentioned earlier that nezek and tsar actually would be payable directly to her, or rather they would be split according to a certain percentage between her and her husband, as opposed to the Dmei Vlodis goes to the husband. We had a whole sugya on that topic. Anyway, the point is, so the Tanya, Rabbi Yossi and Nachi Chaya. Rabbi Yossi says you have to deduct from the Dmei Vlodis, you have to deduct the amount that the husband would have had to pay to a midwife. Meaning, in other words, exactly that. If this woman's pregnancy had gone to term, eventually the husband would have had to hire and pay a midwife in order to help her give birth. Now he doesn't have to do that. So therefore, so Rabbi Yossi says that you deduct that from the Dmei Vlodis. Ben Azai Omer Nachi Mizonis. Ben Azai says you have to deduct the amount that he would have had to pay her extra for like this during the time when she's about to give birth, the time that's called in halacha kishui, when she's starting to go into labor, he would have had to give her extra food, and now there was no labor like that, so therefore he doesn't have to pay her the extra food. So we see that both Rabbi Yossi and Ben Azai hold of this concept that you have to look at what there would have been in the what there would have been in the future, and the and now therefore he doesn't have to pay that, and therefore you deduct it. Rashi says we're only talking about the time during her labor. The Rashba mentions you have also there's also the point that she needs better quality food during that time. There's also when she's nursing she needs extra food. Anyway, so the point is Ben Azai is saying you deduct all of that. Now, do Rav Yossi and Ben Azai disagree? The Gemara mentions, by the way, Manda Omanaki Chaya, Rav Yossi, who says you deduct the amount that you would have paid for the midwife, Kol Shekin Naki Mazonis. All the more so, he would say, like Ben Azai, that you also have to deduct the extra Mazonis because now there's none of that. Or Manda Omanaki Mazonis, but Ben Azai, who says that you deduct the Mazonis, he would say only those. Avonaki Chaya Aloy, but he would not say that you deduct the value of the cost to the midwife, the Omale, because the husband can say to the Mazik, it's a deep kichahi. My wife is a short one, Veloy Boya Choya, she doesn't need a midwife. As we find in this week's parasha, the midwives used that same argument to parry. They give birth by the time the midwife comes. So the husband would have a right, says Ben Azai, to make the same argument. My wife is very on the ball, and she's able to give birth even without a midwife. So I didn't gain anything from not having to have a midwife because my wife is the type that wouldn't have needed that anyway. The Gemara, by the way, in Sota, when it deals with that argument of the midwives of Shifra and Pura, the Gemara asks, what do you mean? The fact is, even a midwife read the story. Not necessarily to assist with the actual birth. I see there was just a glitch now, so hopefully you guys were able to hear the last few minutes. If not, then tell me.
Is the recording?
Yeah. All right. Anyway. So again, according to Ben Azai, the point is we don't have the mazik can't get away with deducting from the dmei vlodis the amount that the husband would have paid a midwife because the husband has every right to say that not necessarily would there have been a midwife in this case. Okay, now getting back to all of this was kind of a digression from the main topic which we were of the sugya, which is the question of how we evaluate the damage. Beshishim. We said that if an animal goes into somebody else's property and eats, then we evaluate beshishim. On the other hand, we said earlier in the sugya on Nun Chesem and Beis, we had a case where one person chopped down a palm tree belonging to somebody else. So Rav Nachman had also first, we said the Reish Galusa had wanted to say the guy should have to pay the full value of the tree. Then the mazik went to Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman said, you go beshishim. And Rava had asked, why? Is it necessarily the same thing when the animal damages versus when the person himself causes damage? So now, getting back to that point, Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brede Reshua Ovud Uvda Kavased Rav Nachman B'Shishim. Once happened a similar case involving Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brede Reshua, where one person chopped down somebody else's palm tree, and they also figured B'Shishim. So they held like Rav Nachman that you always go B'Shishim. On the other hand, Lishna Achrina, a different lotion of what happened is no, the Papa Vanoda Beda Vishua, Shamudikla Agav Ktina Da'ara. That a second version is they didn't figure it out relative to Shishim, rather, they figured it out relative to a small plot of land. So either way, it's not like the Reish Galusa who said that you would evaluate the tree individually, but they're not necessarily going to Shishim either. There is some discussion among the Mephoshim whether it really is the same thing. When they say Katina Da'ara, a small plot of land, do they mean that we're figuring relative to a small plot of land that has 60 palm trees in it? Or do we mean that in this case they would hold somewhat different than Rav Nachman, and they would say that actually you just figure the value of the tree relative to the value of the land rather than the value of the tree independently. Anyway, the Hilchsa Kavaseder proper Vrevhuna Vredevishua Bedikla Da'amar. The halacha actually ends up being a hybrid. It depends. The halacha is like Ravhun, like a papa, and Ravhuna Bredevishua when it comes to a Dikla Armar. Literally, that means a Syrian palm tree, although a bunch of the Rishonim explain that it means actually a Roman palm tree. And the Hilchsa Kavase de Resh Galusa, but Dikla Parsa. On the other hand, the halacha is like the Resh Galusa, who said that you figure according to the individual value of the tree when it comes to a Persian date palm. Now, what's the difference between them? So Rashi explains that a Persian date palm is very choshu. So it's very important. So therefore, you would evaluate it individually. In the case that went to Rav Nachman, where at first the Reish Galusa had said that you have to pay the full value of the tree, if the tree was a Dikla Parsa, then in fact that would be the correct halacha. At the beginning of the sugya, in fact, we said that when this happened, when the Reish Galusa judged it that way, the guy said, "What do I need a Reish Galusa who's judging a dinner to Parsa?" So Tosfos had mentioned over there two possibilities. Either the guy means that the Reish Galusa is judging the way the Persians do, meaning not al pi halacha. Let me go to a rov who will pass al pi halacha. Or the other possibility he meant, the Reish Galusa is judging as if this was a Persian palm tree. Well, if it was, so now we're saying, if it was a Persian palm tree, then in fact the Reish Galusa's psak would have been correct. So was the Gemara saying now, just that in that case it was not. Anyway, so that's one point, is that the one way of understanding it then is that the Dikla Parsa is much better quality, and therefore it's counted individually. There are several other understandings among Rishonim. Another understanding is it's not talking two different kinds of palm trees, but rather a Dikla Parsa, the Rosh gives an explanation, a Dikla Parsa is one that's fully mature. So therefore, it would be very easy to uproot it and replant it someplace else. So the same way as Reb Shimon had said in our Mishnah that when it comes to fully ripe fruit, you go according to that. You pay according to the full value of the fruit. And the Gemara is going to talk on Amud Beis that the halacha is like Reb Shimon. The same way over here with a fully developed palm tree, where you could do the same kind of thing. You could plant it someplace else. Then we would treat it like fully ripe fruit, and he'd pay the full amount, as opposed to a Dikla Arma would be when it's in an earlier stage, where you can't, where if you replant it, it's not going to grow well. So that's another way of understanding it. And then there are various other points that Rishonim make about what the difference is between a Dikla Parsa and Dikla Arma. In fact, there's an explanation. The Rambam gives an explanation that what it means is a Dikla Parsa. It's not so much that the tree is better quality, it's rather that the fruit is better quality. So therefore, when it comes to a Dikla Parsa, we have to calculate the value of the actual fruit, as opposed to a Dikla Arma, we would calculate the fruit only relative to the tree. We would say, how much was the tree worth when it was laden with this fruit versus how much is it worth now that the animal ate the fruit? So that would be another way. And then there's actually an explanation of the Rabbeinu Yohannesson gives an explanation the other way around. A Persian palm tree is not as high quality as a Roman one. So if you were to calculate it individually, then if you were to calculate it relative to the value of the land, the Nizek would end up losing out, because the difference between a piece of land that has a Dikla Parsa and one that does not wouldn't be very much. Therefore, you have to calculate the value of the tree individually, in order that the mazik has to pay a decent amount. So different explanations among the Rishonim what the difference is between these different kinds of trees. Okay. Now, more on this topic of palm trees and their fruit and about the damage to them and what happens with the future value of it. So the Gemara tells a story. Eliezer Ze'ira, Eliezer the Little, that was his name, one time he was wearing black shoes, and he was standing in the street of Nahauda. Black shoes, Rashi explains, in those times, only Avelim would wear those. Tosfos actually discusses that many people would wear black shoes, but Tosfos says usually people would wear black shoes with white shoelaces. Here he was wearing with all black, including the shoelaces as well. There's different, again, there's different understandings among Mefarshim, and there is another explanation that most people would wear glossy black shoes, whereas he was wearing flat black. Whatever the case, it was a clear sign of Avedus. So people from the Reish Galusa's household, the Reish Galusa being the governor of the Jews in Bavel, he had, among other things, he had a police force at his disposal to be able to enforce the law when necessary. So they found him standing there in the street. And they asked him, "Why are you wearing these kinds of shoes?" So he answers, "I'm mourning for the destruction of Yerushalayim." Now, this is a few hundred years after the Churban, and he's saying that I'm wearing these shoes in mourning for the Churban. Okay. Sover, they thought these servants or police of the Reish Galusa, they say, Omrulay, they say to him, "Do you think you're important enough to be making a public display of mourning for Yerushalayim? A chosh of a person should be doing that. You can't have stam people wandering around and saying, I'm doing this because of Yerushalayim. Sover, you are Rahava. They thought he's acting in a very proud way. He's like putting on airs, like, look at me, I'm such a frum, look at me, I'm such a frum yid. And the Gemara discusses, is that a matter of Yuhara? Is he saying, look at me, I'm able to be Mechaven even under conditions like this? Or are we not worried about that? Fine, because the saying Krishma under such conditions is not necessarily clearly a matter of Yuhara. You could understand you could understand it differently. Similarly, with an example in Psachim, it talks about that you're not allowed to, that you have a case where when it comes to Tanias Tzibur, Taman Chachamim shouldn't be working, and every person should act like a Taman Chacham, because you can always say, listen, I don't have any work to do right now. So there's always things with Yuara where you can say, maybe it's showing Yuara, maybe not. But here, Marsha points out, wearing these kinds of shoes is clearly, unequivocally Yuara. So they thought that it was, and therefore Asiru B'chavshua. So they put him in jail. Because that's their job is to enforce proper behavior among Jews and to be walking around like that in the way of Yura, they consider it is not the right thing to do. Omalahu Gavra Rabbana, but Eliezer Zira tells them, I'm a great person, meaning I'm a Tamil Chacham. I am worthy of showing public mourning for Yerushalayim on this. Now, how could he do that? He's trying to save himself by saying he's a Talmud Chacham. Marsha points out we have a story in the Nedarim where Reb Tirfin did that and then he regretted it for the rest of his life. So Marsha says, because over there, Reb Tirfin could have bought his way out with money. He could have offered the case was somebody thought that this fellow was stealing his figs, and Reb Tirfin could have just paid him for the entire year's crop of figs or grapes or whatever it is that the guy had claimed had been stolen from him, and he didn't have to reveal who he was. So Marsha says over here, this Eliezer Ze'ira is poor, he can't easily get out of that, therefore he has a right to say that therefore he has a right to get himself out of this trouble that because he's a Talmud Chacham. Ben Yehoyada points out, I mean, still, on the contrary, then, you know, so fine, let him sit in jail for a little bit, and then he'll tell them, why is he, like, trying to preemptively avoid the problem?
Actually,
Marsha says, that's the point. The question is, we're saying they actually put him in jail. Why only when they put him in jail, why then all of a sudden did he wake up and say, Gavra Rabban?
You don't want to get in jail in the first place.
That's Ben Yoyada's question is, yeah. why did he wait until that point?
You don't know where you're getting out.
So he explains somewhat differently. The difference between him and Reb Tirfin, they're arguing, they're saying that you're doing this out of cover. You're doing this out of Yuara. So now he's saying that this is a big chashad. This is a big, a very serious accusation. So he's saying, no, you shouldn't think that I'm doing this because I want people to honor me. I am a guy. Avir Rabba. People already give me honor. I don't need the extra honor of that I'm showing off mourning for Yerushalayim. So the reason, so then in that case, so then he has a valid reason to tell them on the grounds of the Yisim Niki, Mashem Yisrael, that you have to be, when a Yid accuses you of something, you have to be able to demonstrate that you're not guilty of that accusation. So therefore he's doing that. So that's another. So that's Ben Yehoyada makes that point. That's why he said that. There's a sefer called Agra de Pirka from the Bnei Yisachar. He says another point as well. He meant it for the sake of the honor of Yerushalayim. If they think that there are average type people going around and showing public mourning for Yerushalayim, then it's a bizoyan for Yerushalayim that it should be like that. So he's saying, on the contrary, I'm a Gavri Rabba, and therefore standing up for the honor of Yerushalayim. Anyway. So they said, you're saying you're Talmud Chacham, how can we show it? So he tells them, fine. Either you ask me something in Halacha and I'll answer you, or I'll ask you something. And as I say, a good question itself is half the answer, and you can see from a person's questions whether he's a Talmud Chacham. Why is he doing it that way? By the way, Ben Yehoyada points out, because if he just says to them, I'll tell you a bunch of halachas, that wouldn't be a proof. Maybe he memorized them, he just learned it now or whatever, like this. When you have something that involves svara, then it shows it is Talmud Chacham. Okay, so Omrule Boi Ak, so he says, they say, you ask the question, we'll see how we can deal with it. So Omalu, so he asks them, hi, then this is the reason why this is coming in over here, is because this is relevant to our sugya. Hai man dekotz kufra. What would happen if a person chopped down from somebody else's tree kufra, which is unripe dates? Now, Rashi explains, the same way as we learned on Omar Aleph, when it comes to grapes, you have a stage called boiser, where they're the size of a white bean. That's when they're first considered fruit in halacha. However, you can't really use them for anything at that point. They're not ripe enough. The same stage in dates is called kufra. So they're not really worth very much. So if somebody chopped off kufra from somebody else's palm tree, my mashalim, how much does he pay? Omrule, they said, Mashalim may kufra. What's the question? He pays the value of kufra. Well, right now, kufra isn't really worth anything, so he wouldn't be paying. But he says, what do you mean, vahavu tamri? What do you mean that kufra eventually would have grown and become dates, which have a value? Omrule, they said, that's a good point. Okay, Mashalim may tamri. Well, then he has to pay according to the value of dates. Omalahu, he said, Ba'alab Tamri Shokamine. The fact is, he didn't take dates, he only took kufra. So Omrule Aimalon at. So they said, fine, we give up. What do you say? Omalahu Bishishim. So he said, you evaluate according to 60, like we've been saying throughout the Sugya. Because after all, when a person, Rashi points out, when a person is buying land with unripe fruit in it, he takes that future value into consideration. He knows it's not 100% for sure that they will grow and become ripe dates, because like we said before, there could be any number of things that go wrong in between. But he does price in, when he's figuring the value of the land, he does price in, we have these unripe dates, there's an X amount percentage that they are of likelihood that they're going to become ripe dates, and he figures and he prices that in accordingly. So you do the same thing over here, and you do that with 60 times as much, 60 palm trees like that. So they say, they told him, well, who says like you? I mean, you're saying that, fine, it sounds logical, but do you have any source for what you're saying? So he says, Yeah, Shmuel is alive and his Beis Din is in session. Go ask him. So they sent a message to Shmuel. And Shmuel says, Eliezer is telling you correctly that you evaluate according to 60. So therefore they left him alone. They realized he is Taka Tamad Chacham and he's worthy of showing public mourning for Yerushalayim the way he was doing.
Means
they released him.
So he came from a different place. That's what he didn't know.
I guess he came from a different place. Yeah.
That'd be like a Satmar guy.
I don't know what he was, whatever.
But going over here, and the police aren't going to arrest him.
So that's we don't have the same sensitivity towards the nuances of Yiddishkeit as they had then. When it's not a matter of a Satmar Chassid, for example, let's say is wearing a different type of strangle. Fine, we see that all the time. But when we see, really, if we see somebody acting with Yuhara or somebody else acting in a way that's inappropriate for a Yid, we should have the sensitivity to realize that something's wrong. These people of the Reish Galusa had that sensitivity and they realized this is not the way for a Yid to behave. We lack that for a number of reasons, but
they were going.
Who says that? What do you mean they were going? The Reish Galusa himself is a Yid.
No, the one that arrested him were Yid?
The pashtus, yeah. They were Yidden.
So really?
The Reish Galusa himself is the governor of the Yidden of Bavel. But pashtus, his police force, was Yidden. Yeah.
They would arrest the Yidden.
Yeah, well, because, again, he's behaving improperly, at least the way they saw it. Yeah.
Will you let a new
start? Okay, let's go.
Okay.
Okay, we said in the mission, Reb Shimon ayma ochel peiros gmurim chula. We said that Reb Shimon had said if the animal ate fully grown produce, then you pay the full value of the produce, meaning all this that we were saying up until now that we figured b'shishim was only Reb Shimon had said only if the produce was unripe. Or we discussed on Amud Aleph various stages of unripeness, but the point is he's saying once the fruit is ripe, then we just go according to the actual value of the fruit. We said this fruit is worth $10 a pound, so he pays $10 a pound, and that's that. So my timer. So the question is, why does Reb Shimon say that? Didn't we learn earlier that when the Torah says that the animal goes and grazes in another field, and we said the word b'steyacher means malamet sheshamin al gav hasadeh? Because it doesn't need the field, then therefore you should have to pay for them in full. He can't argue with a drosha on a pasuk, but he's saying the drosha of the pasuk is only meant to apply when that thing has to be in the sod, as opposed to now when it's already ripe and it could be harvested any time. Then it's different. Incidentally, a very interesting point that comes from all of this. We've been saying all this time that you're evaluating the shishim. So there's an interesting point that a couple of Achronim talk about. It's brought in the name of the Chofetz Chaim. It's brought from Reb Chaim Brisker. By the same token, suppose a person breaks a window in somebody else's house. Now, the actual window itself, we might say, it costs a couple $100. On the other hand, maybe we should consider it relative to the rest of the house. If you were to sell the house, you wouldn't lose very much of the value of the house because of one broken window. So then you should figure it the same way. So that would mean, in other words, the mazik would be paying nothing or next to nothing. On the other hand, the Chazan Ish disagrees with that and says the difference is with a field, you could very soon sell it. You could sell the crops in it. You could sell the field itself, as opposed to a house is not something that's likely to be sold short term. The person is living in the house. Therefore, it's a different thing. Therefore, you wouldn't evaluate relative to the house or relative to shishim or anything like that. You would just evaluate relative to the actual value of the replacement cost of the window.
And a window can make or break a deal. I've seen this on.
Maybe, but most of the time it won't. Most of the time, you're selling a house in a good location or whatever. There's one window broken or one little minor damage. Yeah, the guy will deduct a few dollars for it. He's not going to break the sale. Anyway, so the Gemara continues. It once happened that Rav judged in a certain case, like Reb Meir, which we're going to explain in a minute what we mean by that. And there's also a time when Rav passed, so there was a practical din Torah, and he passed him like Reb Meir in a certain case. Or posak hilchasak Reb Shimon. There was also he taught his talmidim that the halacha is like Reb Shimon in the Mishnah. Now the reason why we're mentioning them together is because both of them are something unusual. Usually yochid v'rabim halacha k'rabim. Here these are two examples where Rav passed him like a yochid. In one, in a din Torah, and the other way he taught his talmidim. What do we mean by this? So, Kirab Meir de Tanya, where Don Rav Kirab Meir de Tanya, where do we have the example that what Rav Meir is talking about? So, we learn in a Braisa. We have a case in Masechta Ksuvos in Masechta Ksuvos. Where we know that we know a woman's ksuba is usually payable out of karka. So you often have a man will designate a particular field of his that this is going to be the one designated for ksuba. So now, nowadays we usually don't do that. First of all, many Jews don't own land or real estate or whatever. There's already a takana from the goyim that the ksuba can be collected from the talpin. But and then in general, all debts can be collected from the talpin. But here we're talking about so. Cost of Larishon. So if a husband wrote to a certain person that he wrote him out a document that he's selling him this particular field that's designated for his wife's ksuba. Veloy chosmoloy, and then the husband signed off on this, and then the guy took this document to the wife that she should sign on it, and she refused to because she said this field is designated for Maksuba. I don't agree that my husband should be able to sell it. Then the husband went to another potential buyer and this time she did sign off on it. So the mayor says by that she's forfeited her ksuba because she's saying that she can't say nachas rocha sisi labayli. You have a concept that we learned many times in ksubas that she can say I'm only doing this in order to get along with my husband, but now you can't do that because then she would have done that the first time around. So obviously, therefore, Rabbi Meir says it means that she's forfeiting her ksuba. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Yecholah Hishtoim, and Nachas Ruach Hasisa LeBayli. Rabbi Yehuda says even then she can still say. Rabbi Yehuda says she can still say Nachas Ruach Hasisa LeBayli. Atem Malachem Alai. What are you arguing against me? I haven't forfeited my ksuba just because of that. So now, even though usually when we have Rabbi Meir against Rabbi Yehuda, usually the halacha is like Rabbi Meir. Here Rav Paskin like Rabbi Meir. So the mayor had said again that since this happened already with a second buyer, Tosfos refers to something that says in the Gemara and Ksubas over there, if it was the same buyer, even Rav Meir would agree that she can say Nachas Ruach Hasisi LeBayli because it's the same buyer. It's trying again. So fine. I'm signing off on it, but not because I'm actually willing to forfeit my ksuba, but rather just because I don't want to start a fight with my husband.
Maybe she thought that he was so hurt the first time that she went to give him Nachat Ruach the second time.
Yeah, but Rav Meir doesn't take that into consideration. Tosfos also talks about there's a difference whether if she wrote a shtar of her own, for example, there'd be a difference. But the bottom line is Rav Meir is saying there can be a case where because she signed off on the sale of this field, then she forfeited her ksuba. So now Rav Paskin like that. What do we mean that Rav Paskin like Rav Shimon? Namely in our Mishnah, Rav Shimon am ochel peres gmurim, mashalamis peres gmurim, im sa sav, im sasayim, where he had said that if the animal ate fully grown fruit, then you pay according to the actual value of the fruit, one saw, two saw, however much it was. So Rav is saying that there the halacha is like Rav Shimon, that you do that. Now, Rabbi Hanan relates this to, and Tosfos also discusses over here, this may be related to the general point called Kola Umid Ligzes Kigozu's Dummy. When you have something that's ready to be cut, then it's considered as though it was already cut. So here, since this produce is already ready to be cut, then we would consider it as though it was already cut from the ground, and therefore we would say that if the animal had gone and eaten fruit that was already detached from the ground, no question, you'd be paying according to the value of that fruit. So now Rav is following the same principle over here. On the other hand, there are other Mephoshim who argue and say that there might be a different. There's a long shach on this Indian in Shulchan Aruch who discusses this point and says there may be a distinction. There may be a different consideration behind this.
This is basically with regard to
as far as the evaluation. No. This is talking about where the animal went in there and ate normally. Where the animal went in there and ate normally, where you're paying mashi hizika. So we're saying, so in most cases, you're paying according to an evaluation 60 times as much, according to Rashi, the double evaluation, according to Tosfos, the single one. And then, on the other hand, where it's peres gmurim, then Rav Shimon is saying you go according to the actual value of the fruit, and Rav is passing it like that. Okay. The Mishnah says, here's another Mishnah as far as an animal eating somebody else's produce. If somebody makes a pile of grain in somebody else's field without Rishus, so this is similar to cases that we had earlier in the Masechta where somebody brings in his payrus without Rishus into somebody else's property. So here he made a whole pile of his grain over there. And an animal belonging to the owner of the field ate that grain, potter. Then he's potter. If the animal was injured by them, Bala Godish Chayev, then the owner of the stack of grain is Chayev. We've talked about earlier whether what it means that the animal was injured by it doesn't mean that it slipped on it or doesn't mean that it ate it. So we had before, we had Rav saying before that the owner of the grain can argue the animal didn't have to eat it. I shouldn't be responsible for the fact that it ate the grain and became sick from it. And that's how it is. So on the other hand, continues the Mishnah, but if he put that stack of grain there with reshus of the owner, then the owner of the field is chayev to pay for any damage to the grain. And if the animal gets injured by it. If somebody brings in his payrus into somebody else's reshus, and we had, or he brings in his shur, his kalim, we had different cases in the mission over there, and Rebbe had said, always it has to be, when is the owner chayev for any nezakin, only if he says, I will watch it. Now here he didn't say I will watch it, and yet the Mishnah is being mechayev him to for any damage to the grain, yeah? So does that mean our Mishnah is not like Rebbe? I'm a papa, but a papa says no. Hocha benotar be'dori askin. What we're talking about over here is where you have the one person who guards all the stacks of grain. Meaning, Rashi explains, people would often, you'd have like one big valley where there are many individual fields in it. People would often have, there would be one particular central area where everybody would have, instead of having everybody have their own individual stack of grain, and then they have to have their individual watchmen over it to make sure that animals don't eat it or people don't steal from it or whatever. Instead, they would have one central area where everybody would have their piles of grain, and then they would have one shomer to watch all of them. So therefore, to kiven to omele ayeluk doish. So now, when the owner of the property says, "Come in and make your pile of grain here," ayova enter lachahu. It amounts to saying, "Come in and I will watch it for you." Meaning in other words, that he's saying exactly that. Since I'm making this property of mine available for everybody's stacks of grain, then I'm also implicitly I will watch it. So even Rebbe would agree that in that case he doesn't have to say explicitly that I'm going to watch it because it's assumed. And in fact, Tosfos says that is exactly the chiddush. Why is this mission even needed? Why isn't it included in what we learned before about the case where somebody brings in payrus into somebody else's reshus? So now we have two understandings. Either the Gemara means that tells us that the halacha is not like Rebbe, meaning this is an example of machloikas v'achakach stam, where we have first machloikas in the previous perek, and then we have a stam mission over here, not like Rebbe, and that would tell us the halacha is not like Rebbe. Or, as the Gemara is saying, that in this particular case, even Rebbe would agree, and therefore that, and either way, the point is that that's the halacha.
Sure.
Everyone.